Welcome to Investigating, a movie and television rewatch podcast where we're currently analyzing each episode of Stranger Things with no spoilers.
We are your hosts, Leia
and Sarah.
And if you love Stranger Things, this is the podcast for you.
Welcome back to Investigating Stranger Things. Today we are talking about Season 3, Chapter 2, The Mall Rats, written and directed by the Duffers, aired July 4th, 2019. And today we are joined by our first guest of Season 3, Naj. Welcome, Naj.
Hey, everyone. Wait, I'm the first guest?
You're the first guest of Season 3?
Yes, I feel so special. yes, I'm so excited to be here. I think this is going to help me remember some things because I think I overhyped season 3. I think it was during the hypeness of like COVID. So staying in the house and watching this was like the best thing ever. But maybe listening and talking with this podcast, I'll rethink some decisions. And, yeah.
What did you guys think of this episode?
You go first.
I'm getting the sense that Naj was not a big fan of this episode.
I liked the episode for a couple of things. I did like the introduction of Elle and, Max's relationship, especially after, like, how it was in season 2 where, like, it was, like, this apparent, like, beef on one side. I did like that we got to see Elle act like a child, like, you know, a girl for once and not be in this kind of, like, this kind of atmosphere where she has to be secluded to, like, rules of, like, having to be home by this time or being, you know, everything locked down. She was, like, free for once. I did hate the Mike and Elle thing. I feel like this is where they start to lose me as a shipper at the time because of this.
It's
sad to see. Because like even like when I got done the show, obviously I was still like I always prefer like one ship over the other. But watching it now, I'm just like some of the stuff could be just an easy communication, especially when y'all were like separated in season 2 for a long time. I thought you would not want to take it for granted, but we'll see that. The government storyline, I just could not care about at all. I just could not. I can't.
With the mayor?
Yeah, the mayor situation. The Billy situation. I don't care about Mike.
I don't care about Billy. I don't care about the government.
There's too much going on in this episode. I felt like
it was
like,
too
it
much.
It felt like we were being pulled in so many different directions. Like
in such little time too. I feel like they were trying to soft launch it, and it's crazy because I didn't even think all this happened by episode 2. I thought this was like mid season 3. So when
everybody have that experience?
I'm telling you. So when I saw like I saw the mall, I saw the rat, I saw the mayor, I saw the Billy.
You're
I
like
saw
already
the ice cream place with the Russians, and I was like, wait, this is all episode 2? And I had 51 minutes, and I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, I mean this episode was fine, but like I said, I feel like there was just too much going on. Like I just felt all of it felt so opposite of each other too. Like the stuff with the kids was very lighthearted and very, you know, like rom-com, you know, they're at the mall, they're doing all these cute stuff, the relationships, you know, her and Max and Elle are like getting closer, the boys are off doing their own adventure, and then you had like obviously the stuff with Billy, which I think was the most interesting part of the episode. Like that's what what I wanted to find out more about.
Yeah,
and it felt like it just kept cutting to a different scene that I didn't care about as much, and then going back to Billy, and then the Russian thing. Like it's hard because I like that Dustin and Steve are like hanging out and now Robin's in on it and stuff. But I just, again, I don't really, they haven't like intrigued me with the whole Russian storyline so far. And then obviously Hopper and Joyce. Yeah, it just felt like, and then Nancy and like everybody was just very separate and there were so many things going on. And I'm like, where do I look? Like I'm lost.
And then you had Joyce with the magnets too. So she went to like the school, yeah, with the teacher, and then was talking about the magnets about as that. Well. It was like, yeah, just, it was just so much. I mean, I think between like everything that I watched, the Billy situation was intriguing, and I actually started like making like some parallels today. I was like, whoa, between him and like, you know, Will of it all. But then I was just like, well, every time we see him and we're getting intrigued, it flips to something else. And like, you know, like,
yeah,
like and I get it, because like we watched like the first two seasons, and like every time they'll do that, it will make sense because everybody will be finding something that kind of like overlays to where like it's vague connection. This has no, yeah, connection at all. Like when they were talking about the Russians, I was like, is this season 4? And I was like, oh no, this is season 3. So I don't know how this, yeah, will play to us, but we'll see.
Like, I get it. I feel like they're trying to do this thing where it's like, oh, you know, everyone thinks that life is normal and everyone's kind of going about their day, but really there's like dark shadows lurking underneath the surface of Hawkins. But it's like, yeah, we know, like we've been knowing this. But yeah, I mean, it was an episode that had really good moments for me, but overall it was just too jam-packed.
Like, it was stretched thin. You feel like there wasn't enough focus on any one thing.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I liked, yeah, parts of it a lot, just not as a whole, I don't think. Yeah. What did you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I enjoyed the episode because there were aspects, like I really loved Max and Elle, them doing their thing and stuff. I'm appreciating that, unlike with season 2, like the pacing, we start off really fast and then we're just going. I feel like season 2 was so slow for so long. And, mm-hmm, then it finally was like at the last 2 episodes, things were finally happening. But I also remember season 3 really well. And I remember that this pace slows down. So all these storylines that we're jumping back and forth to right now that feel really fast, eventually they're going to start slowing all those storylines down, and then it gets really monotonous somewhere in the middle of season 3. And like in classic Stranger Thing form, they always at the very end bring everybody together. But I personally am not a fan. I understand why they do it with such a big cast. I'm not a fan of keeping your cast all separated and bringing everybody together at the end, because part of the joy of these shows is watching all of the different interpersonal relationships, mm-hmm, and dynamics interact with one another. And I find that the show, starting especially in season 2, really separates its cast and characters. And that just continues to get worse as the show goes on, because they just don't want to put everybody all together in the same room because you get really boring scenes. So it's like, start killing off some people maybe, or maybe like write people out in the organic way. I'm going to be one of those people. I apologize. But yeah, I actually discovered some things about this episode that I thought were pretty interesting that I think might make sense from a thematic standpoint that ties everything in together. But I'll discuss it later on down the line. So that's your guys' little teaser for the episode. So stick around for that.
What was that?
I've been hanging out, okay, with Tony too much.
Okay, Paris Hilton. What did you say?
I said I've been hanging out with Tony too much.
No, I'm saying, what did Paris Hilton say? She's like, that's everybody's hot, a princess.
Oh.
And that's hot. That's
hot. Well, would that make you Nicole Richie then? The Nicole Richie to my Paris Hilton.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go with that.
We're mall rats anyway. I mean, this is, you know, I guess she was technically the 2000s, but I feel like Paris Hilton would be if she was in the 80s, she would have been a mall rat, you know?
For sure.
She sure would.
I mean, that's her vibe.
Were we not all mall rats at some point?
It's true.
In our lives.
So true.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But yeah. I don't disagree with you guys at all. I definitely understand. I think I just appreciate the pacing has been fast so far, because sometimes I think that is a big thing with Stranger Things.
It feels like they can't like get it completely right. Like they haven't been able to get it completely right where it's like not, yeah, too fast, not too slow.
Yes.
It feels, yeah, like.
I want a little bit of time to sit with these characters and see what's happening. Like, yeah, there's some weird cuts, like with Billy especially. I was like, no, like, let's stay with this for a little bit. Especially because, yeah, the cold open was Billy, and then we didn't see him till halfway through the episode to continue the, yeah, conversation.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
I honestly think the reason why they're doing this is that since it's the second episode of the season, it's like they're trying to, like, put so much to invest us into continuing to watch the show. Because I think a lot of times with streaming shows, they, like, calculate the first couple minutes of, like, the first couple episodes to dictate, mm-hmm, if they should renew it or not. But Stranger Things is so big at this point that I feel like they shouldn't be afraid to slow down, because so much happened that I can't even remember majority of Billy's scenes, and he's like going to have one of the most significant storylines of the season. Mm. And so for me to see, like, you know, Joyce more than him, or to see like I don't even know, like, other people more than him. Mike. It's kind of just, yeah, oh.
If I have to see one more scene of Mike standing there, the fucking guy, Mike Wazowski from fucking Monsters, Inc.
Right, him and Will. Like, their hair is so
And then Will is just there, can we play D&D?
That's, I think, his only line this entire episode was, can we play D&D? Hey, guys. Can we play D&D now? I'm still here. Can
we
play D&D
now?
Like, we see you, sir. We see you in the middle, lost and confused.
Him and his fuck-ass Bob.
He's like me, though. He's like, can I play DBD? Can I play Day by Day? Like, I have to play. So I'm Chandler.
Well, actually, Naj, you bring up a really interesting point with, you know, they're trying to get viewers to watch and listen and all that stuff because it's early on in the show. I bet you there's something to that, because that's something that they specifically noted, like, when I was doing my research for the first two seasons, that Netflix noticed that episode two is the episode that will make or break the season, and it's the one that hooks people. And they noticed that last season, because they saw, like, obviously the what's the words when you're looking at all the data and stuff, they the saw viewership. The metrics and everything, metrics. Yeah, the analysis, the metrics, they saw all that and realized, oh, it's episode two that hooks people, and that's the one that will determine whether people will continue the rest of the show. So I bet you this episode was made like this so that people would continue on to the next episode. The fast pace to keep people engaged, not get too bored, introducing every single possible character, plot line, story, everything in this one, so that something will hook you. Maybe one, it's like throwing spaghetti at the wall. Maybe one of them will stick.
Billy,
you know,
stuff,
like,
would have hooked anybody right off the bat. Mm-hmm. Like, that,
well, that's
stuff
why it's the cold open, and that's why they didn't continue it till halfway, yeah. And then at the very end of the episode, they're pacing it on purpose so that you will continue and watch the next episode.
And they
guys
got me.
We're watching how streaming is changing before our eyes, between the difference between season one to now. The way they're blocking things is it's intentional to get you to watch the next episode. So,
well,
it's changing
the
story.
I'm going to watch it. I have to watch it.
Did you start watching the next episode?
It started, but I stopped. I was like, I'm going to wait until next week.
Self-control.
I know. It's admirable, honestly. But that's just because she doesn't want to watch the episode twice for the next time. All right. So the episode is entitled The Mall Rats. It's a direct nod to Kevin Smith's 1995 cult classic film Mall Rats, which celebrated the youth culture surrounding shopping malls, obviously. The Duffer Brothers wanted this episode to capture that exact mid-80s phenomenon where the climate-controlled mall became the absolute social epicenter for teenagers, completely killing off the traditional downtown business district. I also love the reference to the actual rats in the episode, as well as to what the kids are doing this episode. And I have, again, I have a whole quote later on where we'll talk about kind of like the mall even almost being its own character this season, and there's like a whole, you know, reason for it and everything. But I have a couple things. So first of all, let's jump into the Reddit stuff, because they were really funny this time. So the top comment is, confirmed, Mike only made up the friends don't lie thing because he's a terrible liar.
Like, Mike, what the hell, bro? He just kept digging himself a hole. I'm like, you can stop now.
Oh, Reddit, though, was all of them, like, he shouldn't be blamed because Hopper was intimidating him as a grown-ass man. And, like, you know, poor Mike and all this other stuff.
He had so many outs. Even as a child, he had so many opportunities to be like, you know what? Like, I've taken it too far.
Yeah,
when you
yeah,
start
literally
talking about Nana's gonna die, like, Mike, come on.
And the mom hearing it, she's like, huh? Mom,
oh, that was so
grandma
funny.
Like,
she's like,
come
what
on.
Nana
almost,
he's like,
put Karen in an early grave just by his lies.
Poor Karen, just trying to stay in contact with what her kids are going through,
just trying to stay away from Billy's
I know she's doing everything she can.
Oh, I forgot that even happened this season. I was like, She's even I'm not gonna say anything until we get to that scene.
Hold it in, Naj, hold it in.
Save it.
The next Reddit quote, who is watching the pool? And somebody else said, meanwhile, Lardass is running happily around the pool. And then the last comment is Barbara. Barbara's watching the pool.
Too soon. Barbara becoming the jokes.
Also, guys, the curse of anyone's with their name starting with B is alive and strong, it seems, so far at the season 100%. With Billy.
That is crazy, though.
The Duffers, Billy? Once you can figure out their format, It's like you start figuring out the show.
Yeah.
You're like,
you crack the
okay.
code.
All right.
Yeah, sadly.
Next one is Steve asking Elle if she's even allowed to be at the mall. Mom of the year.
A single mom who works too hard.
There he is. I paused waiting for Leia. Thank you. Everyone sway. Repeat after me.
Heart of a fighter.
Somewhere out there. Someone's having a drinking game and they're like, damn it, Leia.
Every episode.
Another comment. Have a feeling this is going to be a particularly sweaty season for Billy. You would be correct.
Yeah, he looks very unclean the entire time.
Karen, stay far away from this
man.
He looks like he smells.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then for my fun facts for the episode. So I had this whole thing. I was doing a lot of research on the Me Too movement because I felt like this is a great episode to talk about it with Nancy. And also because I was like, Max and Elle hanging out together, I feel like I know that Millie Bobby Brown had really pushed for a friendship with Sadie Sink's character, Max, because she was like, I really want to see them together. But I also do feel like how female friendship centered and stuff this episode is also a byproduct of the Me Too movement's focus on, hey, let's represent women fairly and stuff. I came across some accusations against the Duffers, and I did not know this was a thing from the
recent,
like, it was during this time when the Me Too movement came out, and they must have some good PR. Netflix buried this or whatever. Someone out there probably remembers. I had no clue that this was happening at the time. So well, let's get into it. So I'm going to talk about the Me Too movement real fast, and then we'll jump into that. Look at me teasing all of you. So in late 2017, right around when season 2 of this show aired, we started seeing the hashtag Me Too going around, famously started by Alyssa Milano from Charmed, where women would post about their experiences with sexual assault, abuse, harassment, and rape culture, specifically in the workplace. But it kind of branched out from there. Like, Me Too has really rippled out, and it's kind of become an encompassing thing for just any sort of misogyny against women and lack of inclusion and such. The phrase Me Too was initially used in this context on social media around 2006 on MySpace by sexual assault survivor and activist Tarana Burke. And obviously this is a widespread problem, but its face was Hollywood when film producer Harvey Weinstein was accused and then eventually prosecuted and jailed. And then in August 2021, the Washington Post analyzed the impact of Me Too on changing behavior. The article states there was a surge of reports of sexual assault in the 12 months preceding October 2018, but that many of the claims related to people coming forward regarding past incidents. The article shows a mixed picture regarding changing behavior, with a significantly smaller percentage of women having experienced sexual coercion or unwanted sexual attention at the office in 2018 in comparison to 2016, but with a sharp rise in subtler forms of behaviors that do not rise to the level of illegal sexual harassment, such as jokes about what is still allowed or telling inappropriate stories, which may have come as backlash to the Me Too movement. The article notes that in response to the Me Too movement, 19 states have enacted new sexual harassment protections for victims. More than 200 bills were introduced in state legislatures to deter harassment. Britannica.com talks about how the Me Too movement's legacy has broadened to encompass issues related to gender equity in the workplace and legal reforms to eliminate barriers that have prohibited victims from coming forward. Some U.S. states have since abolished statute of limitations for reporting sexual crimes and banned non-disclosure agreements that aim to keep misconduct allegations from the public's view. The movement has also led to changes in the workplace and society at large through the implementation of greater safeguards and educational tools that aim to change behavior in future generations. Like, I don't think it can be overstated how much the Me Too movement has impacted almost every area of life. It's hard to remember for us, like, a time when the Me Too movement wasn't so like, it just feels like it changed culture at its core in a lot of ways. Obviously, we still have a lot of work to do, but I just think back to the things that were allowed or not, we just kind of turned a blind eye to in a lot of ways before all of that happened. Some of the things that have happened since the Me Too movement, I mean, the sports, U.S. gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar, with all that stuff with the gymnastics team, music with Kesha, Dr. Luke, Brendan Fraser getting a resurgence with his career after stepping back from Hollywood after being assaulted by a producer, an exec, P. Diddy, R. Kelly. In the religious circles, there have been huge bombshells with the SBC, that's the Southern Baptist Conventions, having tons of investigations and questioning of the lack of inclusion of women in religious leadership spaces. And of course, Epstein files now. Like, it just, it's had a ripple effect in so many ways. And specifically with Stranger Things, Netflix was impacted by this. Most famously, around this time, Kevin Spacey from House of Cards and Danny Masterson from The Ranch, both being fired because of rape allegations and sexual abuse. So mind you, all of this stuff is happening around the time that this season two aired, right at the same time that Me Too movement exploded and stuff. So season three is going to be directly impacted. Then you have all the Netflix allegations. And I mean, House of Cards is like a tentpole for Netflix. It was one of the first shows Netflix started airing at all. So then the Duffers start to hit a little bit of controversy with season two, as we talked about, with Sadie Sink and Caleb McLaughlin's Their Kiss, where people were like, hey, we think that's a little bit iffy, especially because Sadie didn't know that that was happening and stuff. So we talked about all of that. Well, then in March 2018, so season two airs in October 2017, March 2018, the Duffers, everyone, Netflix is getting prepared to do season three. And Peyton Brown, a former crew member on Stranger Things, I believe she worked as a grip, came forward on Instagram on National Women's Day and said, I guess there's no better day than National Women's Day to say time's up, and announced that I will not be a part of the filming of season three of Stranger Things. Why, you ask? Because I stand with my sisters. I personally witnessed two men in high positions of power on that set seek out and verbally abuse multiple women. I promised myself that if I were ever in a situation to say something, that I would. I have 11,500 followers who can hear me say this. Time is up. Women in the film industry are powerful, and you can find that in Screen Rant and also in Daily Mail. So in follow-up comments on the post, she said, there was yelling, there were insults, there were threats, and people were even fired or forced to quit because of them. Following the accusations, Lori Grabowski, a script supervisor for the series, also took to Instagram to reveal that she had been on the receiving end of the alleged allegations or the alleged abuse. By the way, she has an insane resume. She worked on Ugly Betty, The Expendables 2, Teen Wolf, The Lego Movie, Vampire Diaries, Age of Ultron, The Accountant, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Spider-Man Homecoming, Black Panther, Infinity War, Loki, New Girl, and so much more. This girl is insane. In her post, she says, I'm one of those women Peyton referenced. It was very real, not only to me, but other women on the set that also want to share their story. Peyton Brown witnessed not only my experience, but the similar experiences of others. I don't know Miss Brown very well, but what I do know is there's absolutely nothing false about her statement. Myself and other women who are willing to share their stories of our experiences on the set of Stranger Things are living proof. I was the script supervisor of the show for nearly two full seasons. I just could not stand by and let Peyton be called a liar, because what she said is unfortunately very true. Speaking to The Hollywood Reporter on the Saturday after that, the Duffers issued a public apology saying, due to the high stress nature of a production, tempers occasionally get frayed, and for that we apologize. However, we think it is important not to mischaracterize our set, where we believe strongly in treating everyone fairly regardless of gender, orientation, race, religion, or anything else. We remain totally committed to providing a safe and collaborative working environment for everyone on our productions. Netflix added, we looked into the concern that was raised when we heard of the allegations on Friday and found no wrongdoings. Maintaining a safe, respectable atmosphere on set is important to us, and we know it is to the Duffer brothers as well. Brown then reiterated to Daily Mail that she stands behind her post. Grabowski's statement supports her claims as well. She says, I stand behind my original post. I personally witnessed the Duffer brothers, so she names them by name. The Duffer brothers verbally abuse women on multiple occasions. I do not want to be a part of that atmosphere, she said. And then she says, two women have already come out publicly to say that they experienced abuse, and there will be more. Netflix's, in quotations, investigation could not have been very thorough. They did not follow up with other women whose names I gave them before releasing that statement.
Oh my damn. God.
Mind you though, like, this is when two other shows are experiencing, it could be maybe slightly after, slightly before. I'm not sure the exact timeline of when all the Kevin Spacey other stuff happened in association with that, but it's just very interesting. They would have an incentive. I mean Stranger Things was like one of the highest grossing things for Netflix that has remained really pivotal for them. It would make sense that they would have more skin in the game. And if they go, okay, it was just yelling, it was just verbal harassment, it wasn't anything sexual, okay, we'll give them a slap on the wrist and give them a pass. And it also kind of calls into question some of the stuff that happened with Millie Bobby Brown and David Harbour later on. where David Harbour maybe felt like he was a little more comfortable to do this stuff because that was already the tone that was set because of the Duffers. So
yeah, for sure. Wow, that's crazy.
There was one lady that kind of came out. She didn't necessarily say anything about standing up to the Duffers, but she would post like best set I've ever worked at, best bosses I've ever worked at, and they end up finding out later that she was most likely dating Matt Duffer.
Oh.
She was just hyping the set. Just,
she was hyping a permanent
little walking advertisement.
Yep. So yeah, I had no clue about any of that stuff.
I had no idea either.
That's crazy. That was very interesting.
Is there any set that isn't toxic?
At this point, I don't even know.
Yeah, like it just sounds like maybe
men shouldn't be in charge.
Yeah. It sounds like maybe there needs to be something else going on, not set.
yeah
that's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. So like it's just and again I say all these things because I think it's so we don't live in a bubble. Everything is created and influenced by the culture and the things that are happening around that. Just like with Angel, like the stuff that happens on screen is influenced by real life stuff happening. You know, you have characters that have to leave. You have actors that sometimes pass away and you can't continue their storylines and stuff. Like outside stuff influences what often happens to the characters. And so I think sometimes having that context, it allows us to look at things critically. And I think with season 3, the Me Too movement heavily, I believe, impacts. I mean, Nancy's storyline, 100%, I believe, is impacted by everything with me. There's actually even a quote from Natalia Dyer later on talking about that. But I think I sometimes wonder if all of the Max and Elle friendship and stuff like that, although a great storyline, love it so much. I'm like, how much of this stuff was included and emphasized because the Duffers maybe were overcompensating? Look, we love women. We love women. Look at us doing all this stuff, you know? But yeah.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, whether it's that or not, like, it's good to have it either way.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I think it, like, adds to the show. It doesn't seem cheap.
No.
At least to me, you know?
Yeah. Because girls have friendships in real life with other girls, you know?
Like, I think it's a natural progression of, like, Elle's character.
Yeah, I agree. And it's really refreshing.
Yeah, and it makes sense. Because, like, even though, you know, right now it happened in the second episode of season 3, I feel like at some point they would, you know, interact because they're dating two people that are, like, obviously in the same friend group together. So if it wouldn't have happened then, it would have happened, later down the line if they would have brought everybody together. So to me, it didn't feel forced, especially where it kind of makes me happy that, like, Elle felt safe enough to talk to Max about it, especially when, like, last time they saw each other, it was, like, 2:08, and she, like, ignored her when she, like, had the reunion, so the fact that something changed over the 6 months of them her dating Mike to where she felt comfortable enough to talk to Max, either she must have heard about Max and, like, Lucas constantly breaking up to, like, have a understanding of how to know what happens. But I like that she, like, approached her and even know where she was at, because, like, who did she find that out by? Or did she, like, just, you know, use her powers to find her? I liked it. And also, like, the actor's chemistry in real life also made it more believable to me. So, I mean, that's one of my favorite friendships of the show. So
I agree.
But it's also because I love Max. So
Same.
She's the best character of the show, sadly.
Oh, I agree. Agreed, for sure. So, all right. Well, let's jump in. So we are at the abandoned steelworks mill. Thank God, starting from where we left off, because everybody wants to know what happened. Mm-hmm. We get some really cool shots and cuts. Honestly, I really enjoyed the sequence of events. I like the way that they spliced it together. It created this anticipation, kind of how we were like, we see Billy coming out of the mill. He's bloody, he's screaming, he's slimy, he's traumatized. And the quick cuts kind of add to that suspense and really add to the energy of the season. So he's terrified. He looks back at the entrance. We hear oozing, bubbling, and then he makes it to his car, which miraculously works now, and then speeds off to payphone to call 911. And then as the operator asks him what his emergency is, he flashes back to being dragged down to the basement by the tentacles, and then this tentacles, like, pumping into him like it did with Will. And I'm like, oh.
Nope.
Oh, right then.
All right.
Then the lights just flash, the dispatcher's voice gets distorted, and then boom, Billy's in the upside down. Guys, we're in the upside down. We, like, didn't go to the upside down at all, like, last
This whole scene is so spooky, and I love the way they shot everything in this scene.
Did you guys hear the clock bell chimes multiple times throughout the episode?
Yeah, I think so.
As soon as Boom Billy is in the upside down, he walks out and you realize he is, you hear the bell chime. And then it happens pretty much through all of Billy's scenes, constant. Mm.
Yeah. Wonder what that is.
I'm not gonna lie, that is, that is something. Yeah, that is good. That is, I'm gonna have to re-listen because, like, I think I heard it a little bit, but I didn't know it was like a constant thing. So I'm gonna have to like re-listen because that's some good storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Some good food.
Yeah, good soup. Then we see a couple of people marching towards him, and then he's like, "What do you want?" We see red lightning flashing, and then one of the people approaches, and it's Billy himself talking to him. Quite honestly, I think one of the most intriguing cold opens we've had on the show so far. I was locked
1,000,000%.
I was like, give me more of this. I want more of this.
It's not anything that we've ever seen before, I feel like.
Yeah, because like, I think when Will had like that connection with the Upside Down, he didn't like directly talk to it. He talked about it. He talked about like the presence of, you know, the Upside Down and like how he can feel it. But like to actually talk to it and actually like the fact that, I don't know what
it was.
It's
a material thing.
Yeah, like we kind of saw like I didn't know that. Yeah, like the entity was actually kind of like smart because it was talking to like Billy and already like having a plan. It kind of gives something else, you know. You gotta stay around. So
TikTok.
Ding. But I liked, and also I think what's called Daiquiri, the actor that plays Billy. He truly sold this because like you saw little bits and pieces, but like you kind of like truly see that he's like confused. And one of the most funniest lines is like, "I don't understand." It's so funny. But like we never had an interaction with. We only like saw like, you know, them killing people, like, you know, Barb or like what Will was witnessing. But this is the first time it made its presence known, and to talk to a human about what it wants. And
yeah, that means it's sentient.
Mm-hmm. And it has like some type of like knowledge of like what we're doing and what it can have us do for it. So now it's like, okay, so what is the next step and why Billy? Because like, for me, just like Billy doesn't have a connection to like the group that kind of like defeated, you know, this Upside Down entity. So for it to choose Billy and be like, "I want you to build," it was so, I don't know. I just was like, yeah. I remember watching it for the first time during the summer, and that's one of like it was one of my favorite episodes. That's why I chose this episode. Like the whole premise of him and how it started was so intriguing, because for him, he just got done talking to like, you know, trying to get a little hookup, and he comes there. And it just chooses him at this right time, like this bad boy who's like misunderstood, has a shitty life, and hold on, I just made a parallel with that too.
Something just hit.
The shitty life. That is so insane. That is so insane.
Same with Will. I mean, there's a reason these people are maybe being chosen.
Yeah, that
they're
just
all,
made,
their
that
names
is...
all their names all start with William.
Why did you almost hit me?
Will and Bill.
I was like, well, you changed your perspective.
No, but you're right, though. Like, yeah. It's fun to go back and see these things and be like, oh, I like it when things actually connect and make sense. And at this point, like, I think the writers are aware of where they're going, which is always nice, which they have to, because one and two were very much their own thing. And you can tell they're building to something else now. All right, so now outside Hopper's cabin, Elle is pacing outside. Mike hasn't shown up. She goes to the phone. Hopper's like, "Everything okay?" He knows it's not. An exasperated Karen answers the phone. And at this point, we don't know if she's gone to the motel and is upset that Billy didn't show or what. So she calls for Mike. We're like, ooh, I see where Mike gets it from. The Wheelers just stay yelling at each other in this house. He's pacing in the basement, looks terrified as he answers. Elle is like, "It's 9:32. Where are you?" And he's like, I just can't see you today because Nana's sick. Elle's like, "That's not what Hopper said." Mike scrambles. It's like, "Yeah, that's what we thought at first, but now we think she might die." Karen's listening and she's like, "What?"
He could have stopped at any moment, genuinely.
He could have just said, "Hey, I just don't really feel like hanging out today."
That's it.
I don't know if he could have said that.
She would have blown up the house and flown over.
She would have come over like right away.
He would have said, "Hey,
like,
I just want to
tell
my friends."
I don't think that's true.
He's like, "You know, I just want to tell my guy friends." We're friends, Mike. Friends don't lie.
Friends don't lie to friends.
He's like, mom says I can't come over. And she's like, I did not. Yeah. He's like, what? But like, that's when you talk to your mom and say, hey, mom, I really don't want to hang out with people today. Can you cover for me? You know?
Exactly.
That's what moms are for. That's what you would do. That's yeah. That's what moms are for.
Exactly.
But then they, you know, there's a huge miscommunication and Elle's like, you're like, I like how she's like, do you lie? Mike's like, no, friends don't lie. And then he's like, I'll see you later. And she's like smelling the BS and is upset. So then she ignores Hopper, who's like, what's going on? Playing all dumb. And then she goes back in her room and we see him looking super smug. And then we hear You Don't Mess Around with Jim playing. And he's like singing along to it in the car. Same song he was dancing to when him and Elle were cleaning up the cabin in season two. He's celebrating. He drives straight
so
to
smug.
Where Joyce is at in Melvald's, rolls in and is like, emotions have been shared. Boundaries have been set. Order has been restored. And she's like, it worked. He's like, yes, this is the first day in 6 long excruciating months that they will not be seeing each other. I'm like, bruh, you're the parent. You do need to set some boundaries every day for 6 months. Okay. Guys,
that's crazy.
That is crazy.
Do they not have like school or like to sleep? Or to shower.
Right. Do he teach her? Like, before the summer thing has, did he teach her this? Like, because I don't know. I'm like, at this point, it's like, granted, yes, but you're also the parent. You were strict in season 2, and then, like, that one blow happened. You mean tell me you never put your foot down ever again 6 months? Or have you been teaching? Like, so is Elle just here sitting in this house, this little cabin house, not learning anything, sir?
Making out, locking lips with Mike.
Right.
No wonder like they're spending all their time doing this, because she can't really do much of anything. She can't go to the mall. That's the point, like, because it would be too much exposure for other people. And I don't know, I think I'm a little frustrated, like, as entertaining as it is, I'm a little frustrated because it feels like we've almost gone back a little bit with Hopper and Elle. It's almost like we're doing the same thing we did in season 2, where they get into a big fight and then Elle decides to rebel and goes and does something. There's going to be some sort of consequences for doing all of that, you know? And like, I would have hoped that their communication would get a little bit better after their really sweet conversation
in
the truck.
That's no fun.
Okay, sometimes it can be. Like, come up with new conflicts, okay?
That's no fun.
Oh,
don't worry. They will have that too.
Right. The conflict should have been her learning and worry about what she should do after summer's over. But alas, let's make it about a boy.
How about her literacy? Can she read at this point?
Yes.
Well, I don't know about that.
Or did she, right? Or did she actually buy the stuff, you know, at the mall? Did Max help her, you know, count?
Yeah,
or
I want to know where
count?
They're getting that money from.
Who's just
buying
nothing.
This stuff?
Like, did they
Mike is like, I have $3.50. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, so what is that worth in 1980, whatever?
Yeah,
that's
literally.
Like worth $20, maybe.
Yeah, not a gold pin. So then Joyce is clapping. Hopper's like, no, it was all you. He's like, I just improvised a little. And he's like, getting to Mike. That was the key. And then he's like, I'll tell you more at dinner tonight at Enzo's.
Ooh.
And then Joyce starts to refuse. This is the second time we've seen her hem and haw about this. He talks her into it, tells her, oh, it's not a date. And she's like, oh, I never thought it was. And then they like kind of do this little dance of, oh, no, I didn't think it was a date. No. And I can't quite get a read on whether or not Joyce likes Hopper or not. Like, we see that he likes her. But I'm like, does Joyce like Hopper, or is she just being avoidant?
I think she's being avoidant.
You think
so?
I
feel like you can see like little bits of her interests shining through.
Okay.
Like when they're bantering and doing all that stuff, like you can kind of see that there's like, you know, she's into it, but I feel like she's definitely very like closed off and
for sure
doesn't really want to go there.
Yeah,
I also, I also feel like maybe it's also because it's been, I'm assuming that if it's been 6 months since, you know, he said 6 months, maybe that's been 6 months since season 2 ended. So it could have been around 6 months to maybe a year since, you know, Bob died. So maybe she's still maybe grieving that, or like, you know, because it probably took a while for her to actually give Bob a chance since, you know, Will's parent, I mean, their father. But I don't know. I feel like I saw the chemistry there. I maybe just feel like maybe Joyce doesn't want to go over that line because they have so many connections with like the kids and other families, and like they know True. Like this, they know the situation of like the upside down. So I don't think she wants to like get close to him, because obviously when she gave Bob that, like, you know, that intermingle into her world, he died literally right after. So I think she don't want to, like, make another step, another commitment in case something else happens, because she already got, like, an inkling of, like, oh, something's wrong because of the magnets. Like, so for her, she's like, something wrong is happening the same time that, you know, he wants to, like, go out. Maybe she's protecting herself. That's what I feel like she's doing.
I think Joyce is traumatized.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 100%. I think
she's real traumatized. And she's just, like, not in a place to...
Maybe she has just been suppressing her own needs for so long that she just doesn't know who she is or what she
and
wants
Jonathan's,
apart from being...
of course.
Suppressing Jonathan's needs, suppressing her needs.
God.
You know, it's just a day in the life of Joyce. But it's almost like her personality was so intertwined with Will's the first two seasons that I wouldn't be surprised if Joyce just doesn't know who she is apart from all of that stuff. And
being
maybe
like
it scares her,
Will's,
you know?
Mom. Yeah, for sure.
You know, not me, you know, speaking my own experience. But anyway, so then.
Damn.
No. Okay. So then. The Powell radios over and is like, hey, people are protesting the mall at town hall. You need to get over here. And then Hopper goes and a bunch of magnets fall down, catching Joyce's attention.
Oh,
second
that's
time
not suspicious at
we've
all.
We've seen this. Yeah, I know. Joyce observing everything except for Jonathan. And then at Hawkins Post, Nancy's getting coffee ready, still thinking about the message on the notepad. She accidentally spills some, of course, is mocked by all the men calling her Nancy Drew. She ends up talking to Tom, the editor, and asks if another girl can grab lunch since she has a doctor's visit with girl problems. I was like, yeah, girl, you use that misogyny to your advantage. You do that. So then she grabs Jonathan, who doesn't think it's a good idea and wants to ask for permission from Tom. But Nancy knows he won't let her go and the story could be a good one. She thinks that she'll redeem herself. She's like, if I write a great story, they're finally going to see me. And
no,
that's not how it works, guys.
They'll just take the credit.
They'll minimize it. They'll minimize it, or they'll find like men just they can't.
They're just
especially
little leeches.
Misogynistic men. They can't possibly applaud a woman for hard work and for doing her stuff, because that would mean a dissembling of all of the things they believe about women and their own view of themselves. So yeah. But you know what, you do the work, Nancy, and you do it for yourself.
Yeah.
In an interview with the Hollywood Reporter in studio, Natalia Dyer talks about Nancy facing sexism in the workplace. Amid the Me Too climate, Nancy's storyline is certainly still as relevant as ever, and this is something that isn't lost on Dyer. While the interactions with her colleagues are hard to watch, the actor explained that it gave her character a chance to deal with a different kind of conflict. It was happening then, it's still happening, but I think to see that in a show that's very fun, and there's a lot of fun elements, and it's a fun thing to watch, I'm glad they threw that in there and gave Nancy this chance to push up against a different kind of conflict, says Dyer, because she's grown into a woman who's confident and she knows she's smart, but this is one of the first times that the world is pushing back. It's so relatable, and of course it's a period show, and to see that and be like, oh yeah, the 80s, but to recognize that people are obviously still feeling this so much, it's easy for me to go in there. I know what this feels like, Dyer said. Of course I do know what this feels like to be looked down upon older men and underestimated, and I think that's a very relatable thing, so I'm very curious to see how people react. I love it. I love the storyline. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it just adds to the fact that Nancy is a badass. Like, Natalia Dyer said, like, this is an additional conflict that she has to deal with. But also, it just goes to show, like, how feisty she is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's, like, you know, I love the attitude of, like, ask for forgiveness later. Like, don't ask
not
for permission. Just ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
And that's so Nancy.
Yes.
Like, she will just dive head in.
Yeah. But I also think it's such a beautiful progression of what we've seen at the past couple seasons, because in season one, she was such a rule follower. She didn't want to do all of this stuff. And I think having that experience of being ostracized based upon her sex, I think people were not giving her the benefit of the doubt because of all of that. And so because of that, she learned to just not care as much about what people think and to just do what she wants anyway. And her becoming a journalist is such a natural progression of all of that, you know?
1,000,000%. Especially with, you know, her role in season one just being so hell-bent on, like, finding out what happened to Barb. Mm-hmm. Like, that was her, and in season two even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with releasing the tapes and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Love it.
I agree. So at the Starcourt Mall, Dustin pulls up to the ice cream place and announces himself to Robin, who has no clue who he is. Dustin's like, is he here? Steve, who is in the back and has his Dustin radar set off, bursts out. Nautical music akin to SpongeBob plays. Both boys are giggling and cheering. They do a secret handshake in front of Robin, who's so confused and says, how many children are you friends with? She's like, loser.
That's their mother. That's not their friend.
Okay. That's mother hen. Okay. That is mother hen.
That's mother
Steve. Not too much, Robin.
Also, he doesn't have teeth again.
Oh, yeah. They were starting to grow in, but they're still not like fully developed. That was so funny. They're catching up, and he's like, she says it's okay. Kissing is better without teeth. And you can see Steve processing this being like,
you know what? Yeah.
You know what? Proud of you, man. Hell good for you. That's kind of romantic.
Kind of so romantic. Right.
Meanwhile, literally anyone else would have been like, ew.
Ew.
So
I love a supportive mother.
And then he asks where everyone else is. Dustin says they ditched him and that they will regret it because he found a secret Russian communication. And then he recruits Steve's help by promising that they could be true American heroes and get all the ladies they want if he would just help him with the translation. I like the little, like, bits of growth they have done with each of these characters. Like, we definitely get the vibe. It feels realistic that Dustin has grown up a little bit. Like, in the last season, he looked up to Steve so much. And this one, he still looks up. But I feel like they're a little bit more on an even ground as far as almost life experience in some ways. Because Dustin's a little bit older now. And, like, he's like, I have a girlfriend now and you don't. So, therefore, like, yeah, you should listen to me. You know, like, he's bribing Steve almost. But it's, like, first of all, on brand for Dustin's ego. But also, like, it makes sense with their friendship.
Yeah.
And their friendship is just so organic to me. I just feel like one thing I loved about this season was that, like, everybody, their relationships and their development was definitely seen. Like, Nancy, her storyline and her progression makes sense compared to season one. Mm-hmm. Steve and, you know, Dustin, their bonding makes sense. And, like, the fact that he even feels comfortable to, like, include him into this, like, investigation thing. Because, obviously, last season, he was, like, Dustin was alone with that Demogorgon baby. So he has somebody that can, like, you know, nibble on his delusions while his other friends are doing other things. Yeah, he has a buddy that can, like, be like, yeah, Dustin, I won't judge you. Let me go ahead and help you with this Russian translation. And he even gained a buddy, Robin, who's, like, judging both of them in the back.
Yeah, this dynamic is very cool.
Yeah, and I really I'm enjoying Robin. Her very dry sense of humor. They've somehow managed to create another very distinct, I know this is like the bar is so low, but they've managed to create another distinct female character, guys, and they're not all cookie cutter. Like, I really am enjoying how dynamic the girl group is in the show, and it's really refreshing. So at the Mayfield house, Max is practicing her skateboarding. This is the scene Naj was talking about earlier. Elle shows up. Again, I agree with you. I think Elle being the one to approach Max is really huge. And then so she tells Max everything, and Max is like, he's a piece of shit. Immediately just supportive. She tells Elle that Mike is lying. She thinks he and Lucas are playing Atari. And then we cut to Mike. I just really love that they do the back and forth with Mike and Lucas, their dynamic, while you also have the perspective of Elle and Max. And then Max is like, if he doesn't fix this or explain, dump his ass. And Elle slowly gets on board and is like, okay, I think I can do this. And in the basement, Mike's groaning in rage. Lucas goes into damage mode, tells him that he can fix this, that he himself has made thousands of mistakes, and that Max has dumped him 5 times so far. And that he has
in the span of 6 months?
In the span of 6 months.
Please. What happened?
Oh, my God.
Like, I need to know what made her so angry that she... Like, Lucas, what did you do? And how much money did you have to, like, constantly buy, like, 4 to 5 gifts?
Yeah, seriously. Literally. $5 here, $5 there. This man is broke.
Chores.
I think one of the reasons Elle goes to Max is because Max has such a sense of self and confidence that you can tell she doesn't need Lucas. She keeps him around because she enjoys him, but he's not someone that she has kind of absorbed her identity with. Unlike the last episode with Elle and Mike, where it's like they're joined at the hip almost.
They're literally like that meme. Like literally that meme where they're just like
the aliens breathing. And are holding hands. Caressing each other. Them. Caressing a little coconut bang guy.
Yeah. Looking all translucent and shit.
But I think part of the reason why there's almost this weird codependency between Elle and Mike, and I think that's what this episode is about, is Elle has no sense of identity and no sense of self apart from Mike. She doesn't know how to form that because she's always been latched onto some sort of man because that's how she was created. She was groomed that way. Not created, but that's how she was, you know, raised. So I think Elle is looking at Max for guidance here, and how do you have this sense of self that's not defined by a man and a boy? And I think this episode is so needed. It's so needed. I feel very passionately about this, guys. Okay, so then they all decide to go take off and do something, and Mike and Lucas are like, let's go buy a gift, and poor Will this entire time has been setting up the D&D board so they'll play.
D&D?
And his voice is like cracking. Hey, guys, I'm still here. He's
like, girl, we've moved on from D&D. Like, let's.
But he was stuck in the upside down for like two of his childhood years.
He was playing real D&D.
Give him his childhood back. Give me my.
He was fighting real monsters.
It was mine first. He's singing Taylor Swift.
Oh my god. He would too. 1,000,000%.
He would. Oh, I mean, well, Noah Schnapp is a huge Swiftie, which is hilarious.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Of course. I'm of so course my is. Jaw remained upright.
Yeah. So at the pool, the female lifeguard is reprimanding some boys playing in the pool, and all the middle-aged moms find her annoying. And I'm like, I know it's supposed to read as if they just want Billy out there, but this is such a real problem in real life where middle-aged women are like hating on and jealous of younger women. So like, ugh, even her noise or her voice is annoying. And so they're like anticipating Billy's arrival. Karen looks anxious. She sees Billy go off to like a storage area where all the chemicals and stuff are, and before he comes out. And so she goes back there to talk to him. He has his back to her. He looks horrible. He's sweaty. And then she reads his body language as angry, tries to explain why she didn't show up the night before. And we're like, oh, you didn't go, Karen.
Thank God.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Because that's a teen. That's a teenager.
Embarrassing and also illegal and also pedophile.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, Drake. That's... Just kidding. And then. So then she's like getting closer to him, talking to him about how she's a family. She can't hurt them. He looks like he's like wrestling with something within himself. He whips around and smashes Karen's head into the shelves. And then we cut and we're like, ah, what's going on? He's going to kill Karen. But it's a fake out. We see Billy like sweating, crying when we come back to it. Like Dacre is doing such a good job of just like you could see the stress on his
turmoil.
Face. Yeah. Karen's right behind him. She's just fine. We realize that he's fighting himself to not hurt her. He finally faces her, tells her to stay away from him before walking away. And let me tell you, this scene has been the, like, in the, like, the buildup to season 5 was, like, one of the most, like, theorized moments of the show. Because people does Karen tie into the end season and yada, yada.
Yeah, I remember there was, like, all this stuff. They were like, Karen is this person, Karen is that person, Karen is the key to everything.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm like, what?
Yeah,
and
I mean,
guess what
again?
she was a mother.
I mean, she was a badass. Yeah, she's a badass woman. But
so then outside, Billy is struggling to stay in the heat and the sun. He does his usual walk to his lifeguard station. If we remember anything from season 2,
it likes it cold.
All right, back at Scoops Ahoy, Erica is taking full advantage of the samples, as she should. What a queen. Much to Robin's disgruntlement. Robin calls for reinforcements, but Steve and Dustin are listening to the recording of the Russians. Steve notes that the music playing on the recording sounds familiar. Robin comes in. She's fed up with having to do literally everything. And then she's like, hey, guys, I know everything you're doing anyway. I know you're trying to decipher this thing. I know it's like Russian. And I speak 4 languages. And Dustin's like, Russian? And she responds in Pig Latin, but both of them are idiots and don't know the difference.
They're
like super impressed. And then she's like, it's Pig Latin. And then Steve slaps Dustin and is like, idiot.
No, he was gay too. Like, he's a liar.
It's just so funny. She's like, I know four languages, so that automatically means that she's going to be able to, like, learn Russian and figure out, decode the Russian message.
It's giving Willow's good with computers, therefore that means she can, you know, go through and...
Or, like, Wesley is a librarian, so therefore he's good with books and stuff, and so therefore he can give birth to a vampire.
Yeah, like, Fred is a physicist. She can go and, like, work with the wires in an elevator cause it to move again.
Yeah, she can dismantle an elevator or, like, an entire security, highly technological security system.
Everything falls under the umbrella of smart.
Yeah.
It gets to a point. You do. It does.
At the Driscoll house, Nancy and Jonathan show up. The old lady who called the reports about the rats, she's so nice. She's sweet. She leads them through where, like, something's wrong. Anytime you have a sweet old lady, nope.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was expecting the Demogorgon to, like, pop out of her skin or something.
Yeah, like that lady that had the alien that came out of her head in Double Meat Palace or something like that.
That's literally what I envisioned.
Yeah. Yep, that's what I was thinking,
that
too.
That memory was
horrible. Sorry, everyone. Hope you aren't eating right now. So then Nancy asks how she knows that her bags of fertilizer have been torn into and consumed by rats. Mrs. Driscoll takes her down to the basement, says that there is something not right about them, suspects rabies. And then when they hear this banging noise, and she's like, oh, yeah, and I caught one, by the way. And we just see this cage covered with blankets just rattling around everywhere. Then we're at town hall. People are still protesting. We see Jim in the hallway. We see this Terminator-looking guy, like the back of him. They make it seem like it's this huge, like, mystery and stuff, but we all saw him in the cold open from the first episode, and he's, like, following Jim around, I guess. Then we meet the mayor, Larry, played by the legend Cary Elwes from Princess Bride, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, Saw, Ella Enchanted. He's basically the king of camp. And you can tell Hop just does not like this guy. Larry wants Hopper to put a stop to the people protesting, saying that they blame him for the mall taking over. There are shops closing, but that's not his fault. That's just how capitalism works. Sounds like every billionaire trying to open a data center right now. Why are you guys using so much water? Ha, should have thought of that before you became peasants. You can't stop progress. It's the American way. Hop's not buying it and is like, they have a right to protest. And Larry's like, sure. But they're supposed to have a permit, so it's within my right to get rid of them.
You don't need a permit to protest.
I think you do if you're on government property.
No.
If you're on government property.
There's no way. No. There's no way. I think this is made up.
It's propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From Larry. Larry protest. Propaganda. So Hop's like, I'm not a politician, but if you do this, it's going to make it look really bad for your popularity for re-election. Larry ignores him, smoking out his cigar, looking out the window and talking about his giant 4th of July party that he's going to throw that will make all the people forget about all the mall fiasco stuff. And then America the Beautiful plays and Larry's like, hey, how about you just do your job? Because I can't plan the party if the protesters are making loud noises. And so then he's like, bye. Interesting. So this is what I was talking about before. So historical context time, history time with Sarah. Woo. This is when everyone's eyes glaze over. No, but I promise it will link together. So the 80s saw a widening income gap, also increasing emphasis on materialism, and thus a new yet old redefinition of the American dream, as the book Ode to Gen X states. I'm going to be covering them heavily. So if you guys want to read more, that's where you can look it up. The author talks about how the American dream always included some sense of being one's own boss, and the idea that through hard work, individuals from across the social spectrum could attain a better, more fulfilling life. This egalitarian nature of the dream waned in the excess of the roaring 20s, but returned with a collectivist sort of view towards it after World War II. So there's this idea that if we all work together to help one another to achieve the American dream, that really, like, rose up during and after the world wars. Well, then after that, there was this idea that, oh my gosh, big government and high taxes are going to destroy the American dream because you're just giving handouts to people. Sound familiar? It really is just cyclical. The 20s repeated in the 80s, repeating now. So this, all of that fear that, oh my gosh, you're giving handouts to people, and that's basically going to take away from my ability to achieve the American dream. Everyone becomes very individualistic again about the American dream, stops being so collective, and that leads to the election of Reagan, and the American dream's pendulum swings back towards individualistic and also materialistic. So now in the 80s, people are becoming disillusioned by the American dream because, surprise, surprise, Reagan economics don't work. And because they're watching their job insecurities increasing, wages decreasing, and even more income inequality. So there's a lack of options. This is all going to sound so familiar. There's now a lack of options for upward mobility for the new young generation. For the first time in American history, the youngest generation, Gen X at the time, is actually making less and has less opportunities for generational wealth and all that stuff than the generations before them. Up until now, each generation was making more money than the generations before. This is not happening anymore because the previous generations are hoarding all the wealth. Familiar. So we're seeing the that boomers? Play out. Yeah. Four generations later, we're all my still, God. Like,
I'm so shocked.
I know. We're shocked by this.
Retire already.
Jesus Christ.
Still haunting us in the year 2026.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so they've been haunting everyone for a while. So we're seeing this play out in the show through our characters. So like Steve's working a mall job instead of being included in his dad's business. Jonathan's desperation to keep his job because he's over there going, I have no opportunities probably for going to college. I'm not, you know, I don't know. I don't have wealthy parents. Like, I just don't know what I'm going to do. And then Nancy wanting to break out of the mold because she sees that she's hitting the glass ceiling and it's limiting her. And so we've had subtle conversations with all the teens about their futures, and all of them are aware that their options are limited. Again, everything today is repeating. Gen X watched age-based entitlements once set aside for youth be redistributed to the elderly, causing Gen X to distrust the economy and the government and leading to them to be apathetic towards politics and placing little importance on citizenship and national identity compared to their predecessors. So in the 80s, patriotism became a really big thing that the government and Reagan was trying to really push upon the next generations as a way to help feed the capitalist machine. Gen X becomes cynical, essentially, and because of this, they have this materialistic attitude of taking back what's mine. Well, I don't have that generational wealth. I don't have any options. I don't have the opportunities of the American dream that my parents had. So basically, I'm just going to take whatever I can right now. And that's how they became so materialistic. They would spend a lot of money going to malls and doing all of this stuff as a way to acquire prestige that was associated with material goods, and that would equate to, like, you know, your socioeconomic status. So the irony, though, is that in doing all of this, they're buying into and reinforcing the capitalistic structure that they're trying to rebel against. So that term is called conspicuous consumption. Possessions are a marker of wealth. So two historians of the 80s, Howe and Strauss, wrote, Gen X absorbed the modern cultural message that their worth is not intrinsic, that they are only worth what others can see. For many coming-of-age Gen Xers, the more physical possessions they had, the better they felt about themselves. Have you guys ever seen Gen Xers with their china cabinets and, like, hoarding their many, many Beanie Babies and all that other stuff? Like,
they really are hoarders.
They're hoarders. This is a product of the 80s. Mm-hmm. So Gen Xers also learned that money was reliable, unlike people. Having grown up in a childhood world that stressed private rights and liberties, they learned that families may leave you, neighbors may rob you, government may cheat you, but money is always faithful. A lot of Gen Xers went into debt in the 90s and 2000s, ironically, because of this mentality. Throughout this book, the author is giving tons of examples of this through movies like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Back to the Future, etc. It's also why Max takes Elle to the mall for shopping as a way to find herself or define herself via conspicuous consumption. In a lot of ways, for teens at this time, the mall was their second home or their third space for them to hang out with each other, and it became its own microculture. So the amount of money you were spending, the clothes you were wearing, the stuff that you bought became your currency, became how valuable you were in your friend group, and you can move up the social ladder, essentially. There's an interesting metaphor here, though. So the mayor's describing the mall as capitalism at work, and at the same time, we see that there's a seedy underbelly with the Russians underneath it, with Mr. Clark talking about how something super large and expensive taking up electricity and power from people, which is clearly the mall, which is also a metaphor for capitalism. And then the mall is taking over the town. People are struggling to, like, put food on the table. It's causing division between people. And then let's compare that with the Upside Down and the Mind Flayer wanting to build an army and is assimilating rats and people into a giant glob of flesh. And now we have Elle, who just wants a normal life, using the mall to define herself. And right, there's nothing wrong with Elle wanting a normal life, wanting to dress like her friends, do all the fun things and stuff. But it's interesting because in doing all of this, Elle is assimilating herself into the culture around her and becoming more quote unquote normal. So I wonder if the show is going to have a cost for Elle of giving up some of her otherness for this assimilation. And it'll be really interesting to see where we go with that this season with Elle and like all that stuff. So I thought that was interesting, and it kind of makes sense why all these working patterns or all the things that are happening together in the episode are all kind of tying together. And yeah, they're trying to show something. Again, it's kind of like Buffy season 4, where it's like, don't give up your identity. Don't give up. Don't conform, essentially. So
yeah,
I thought that was interesting. Anyway. All right, TED Talk
Stop
over.
Villainizing the mall.
Yeah. And, or it just could just be the mall. It's just fun.
I love the mall.
No, yeah, it's totally fun.
Please bring the mall back.
Totally fine. I know. I miss
malls.
Hey,
I still go to the mall.
All right, so now we're at the mall. Elle and Max get off the bus, and Elle's like, it's against the rules. There's too many people. And Max is like, you have superpowers. What's the worst thing that could happen? I was like, oh, girl. It's not like she can erase people's memories of her. What is she going to do? Like,
right.
Pick them up and
she
throw them against the wall.
Break their brains.
Or snap their necks.
Pop their eyeballs.
Oh.
So
Elle's overwhelmed. Max realizes she's never been shopping before and tells her they have to try everything. We pan over. Again, I just love their use of doing two things at once. We have Lucas and Mike and Will trying to find a present for Elle that says he's sorry. At the same time, Elle is trying to find something that fits her personality. And I just love this moment. Max asks her if there's anything that she likes, and Elle says, how will I know what I like? And Max says, you just try something on until you find something that feels like you. Not Hopper, not Mike, you.
Not Hermione, so... not me, not Hermione.
Not me,
yourself.
Not Hermione. Hermione, no, not me, not Hermione. You.
When I make my move. Have you seen them make it into like a song?
Yeah. The Yesified Harry Potter.
No.
Yeah. When I make my move.
I love this moment, you guys. What do you think of this whole like montage with Elle and Max?
This is probably the only part of season 3 that I remember watching vividly because I just thought it was so cute.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it happened so early. I thought it was going to happen later in the season. As with everything else. But yeah, it's very cute.
I'm telling you, everything that you remember happened in this episode, which is crazy.
Yeah, really.
I think this scene was one of my favorite scenes this whole season because, like, out of everything that we've witnessed between, like, you know, Rats and the mayor situation and everything, this is probably the most innocent scene that you ever seen. It's just two kids acting like kids. Because as of right now, you know, like Will, he's like pretty much like his innocence has been traumatized because of what happened in Upside Down. He can't go back to that like innocent world of like, you know, let's play D&D and have this like sense of like normalcy. While with Elle, this is her first ever introduction to like what a girl would do or like what a typical world, you know, day of a girl's life would be. Like she's seeing other girls around her age being at the mall and she's getting to experience it with somebody around her age, because like obviously when she hangs out with Mike, like Mike is a boy, so she's never going to have like that full understanding of what the difference between both of them are. So with Max, she's like getting a chance to understand what the years that she's been robbed out of, and I think Max is teaching her like, you know, worry about what you want for a chance and not like how to please your father figure and your boyfriend, you know, like dress for yourself, you know, and because like it's just sad to see like this 11 12 year old girl asking this person that she only been talking to for a few hours, who is she as a person? So like she doesn't know, probably don't even know her favorite colors, don't even know her favorite food or like what hobby she would
Eggos.
Do. She never had to, Eggos. But she never
had to, her.
Yeah. And she stole it from the store. So like she's finally got a chance to do what she wants instead of trying to, you know, please everybody else. So yeah. Like, the whole photo shoot was just nice. And, like, even the guy probably, like, taking pictures. And I don't know if they can afford those pictures, but letting them get that chance. It was
these
cute.
Glamour shots. Yeah.
Yeah, Max seems to have a lot of money. Or
she stole it
Elle
from Billy.
Elle stole money. Yeah.
Max stole it from Billy. She goes into his night.
Idea.
And then, like, threatens with chopping off his nuts again. And then takes his money.
Oh, my God.
But he's so out of it, he probably don't even remember that he lost money. He's not even aware of what's happening to him.
True.
She's he like, got a clue.
Well, he's been gone for forever. Time to raid his room. Yeah, the colorful wardrobe for Max and Eleven's shopping montage was sourced from real deadstock vintage clothing warehouses. Costume designer Amy Paris intentionally picked bold, geometric patterns and neon prints that were popular in the summer of 1985, explicitly selecting Eleven's colorful romper to symbolize her breaking away from Mike's influence and finding her own personal style, which I'll talk about that in a second. But for Eleven, it was a big opportunity for Paris and Millie Bobby Brown to experiment, since Eleven had been accustomed to wearing hand-me-downs for the last two seasons. The romper that Elle purchases was genuine vintage. Paris had discovered it in a costume house in LA untouched, and it happened to fit Millie perfectly. The sneakers Elle buys are genuine vintage Reebok Freestyle high tops. Since Paris needed multiples due to stunts, she cheated by painting modern Reeboks green, and it's literally my favorite outfit, I think, of the entire series of anything Elle wears. It's so cute and so fun it and is. So tween and young teenager, you know.
Yeah.
And I just love this wonderful book ending of Eleven's style choices over the past three seasons. Like we've talked about, Leia, like she was dressed in hospital gowns and had a shaved head in season one because that's what Papa viewed her as, a weapon, who was basically a blank slate. And then Mike and the boys dressed her in that pink wig, or the pink dress with the wig, as a way to normalize her. But that quickly became apparent, like she's not normal. She has to have some semblance of balance there. And last season obviously was Hopper's overalls that look like they're for boys, and then Callie's punk makeup and hair look for her that taught Elle to embrace her otherness. But here Elle gets to pick her own style and figure out who she is, and she chooses this particular style called the Memphis Design aesthetic as a way to represent that. So I went down a rabbit hole. The Memphis Design was created in 1981 as a direct contrast against the minimalist aesthetic of the 70s. Emphasizing bright pops of color, strong geometric patterns, and clashing hues, Memphis Design took inspiration from Art Deco, pop art, cubism, and more. Artandcontext.org says, among the list of products that they designed and manufactured were Memphis-style furniture, ceramics, patterns, lights, and fabrics. They considered each piece to be a rebellious statement and in no sense timeless, but rather a political statement as a protest of the functional and neutral modernism period. They stood for everything that modernism was against, form instead of function, evoking emotion instead of contentment, contrasting nature instead of integrating it. Memphis Design was all about bringing out the fun and crazy side of humans and evoking positive emotion, even though it was a rebellion against something the group considered stark, cold, and boring. And I was like, oh, that's so perfect for something she would pick to represent herself as she discovers who she is. So it actually ended up morphing into the Y2K aesthetic. I don't know if you can believe that. Yeah. So like our inflatable furniture, Tamagotchis, a lot of it comes from that aesthetic, which is really fun.
So yeah, it's coming back around now.
I know. Yeah. Gen Z's loving it.
Except they don't even do it right.
Yeah. Well, they're making their own thing, right? They're taking a little bit of what we had and they're making it into their own thing. I'm sure that's probably what the people in the 80s thought when they saw ours come around, too. They're like, what is this stupid inflatable thing doing in your room? Those things were so uncomfortable. I remember trying to sit in them being like, oh, this is not as great as it looks.
At least it looks cute.
It does look super cute. So at Melvals, we get a sad shot of Radio Shack being closed down. We see Joyce doing some science research. Then she's looking up electromagnetic concepts as she tries to understand why the magnets aren't working anymore. So then she takes off. She's like, that's it. I can't understand this. Who do I know knows all of this stuff? And then she goes and talks to the most competent person she knows, Mr. Clark, who is enjoying his summer vacay painting D&D figurines in his garage.
Love classic. It. He's such an icon.
He really is. The garage door rolling up.
I feel like he's helped them so much without even knowing.
This man has no clue.
And he doesn't even judge them. He doesn't even judge when he like asks extra questions. Like when she said, like, oh, well, what if this is not normal? Like, what if this is just something else? And he's like, oh, well, I can give you a theory. Like, I would have been like, why are you asking me that?
It's because he's a curious scientist. That's why.
He's just a sweetheart. He doesn't judge. He's over there like he probably was bullied so much growing up that he's like, you know what? I'm going to let people.
I just feel like Mr. Clark is the real hero of the show because without him.
You will be correct. And you will be correct.
I'm just saying, like,
yep.
He really just he gives them so much more information than they would have otherwise.
He's saving lives in school and saving lives outside.
Period.
Absolute king. Listening to Weird Al while he's doing it, too. Love him.
Love it.
Let's just hope his name doesn't start with B, guys.
Oh, no. His first name? What's his first name?
We don't know. We don't know.
Oh, my God. No. I'm so scared.
We don't know.
Run, Bentley, run.
Bentley Clark. Benjamin Clark.
I guess I don't know why I say Bentley when Benjamin's right there. Come Peter on, Benefred.
Benefred? Benefer? Oh, my God.
All right. At Mrs. Driscoll's, Jonathan's taking pictures of the frantic rat while Nancy makes calls around about rabid rats. She doesn't find anything. And then she goes on to call the supply company Mrs. Driscoll got the fertilizer from. In the basement, Jonathan turns around real quick to change out his battery, replaces film. And of course, that's when the rat gets really silent and starts convulsing. And then Jonathan's watching and it's taking for freaking ever for this rat to explode here. But of course, Nancy comes down, interrupts him, says she has a lead, and then they take off and then the rat explodes. And then we watch the rat goo with a tail attached, you guys.
Disgusting.
Move on its own. Upside Down music plays, in case we didn't know that this is a product of the Upside Down, guys. I was really worried. I was afraid that this was something that happened in everyday life.
I mean, I guess this screeches and screams and growls. That didn't give it away.
The tentacles, the lightning, the ash looking stuff, Billy's hallucinations. Yeah. Just absolutely no clue, you guys.
No idea.
In the Upside Down, thank God we're finally back to Billy again. He's like, what do you want? We're like,
what do you want from me?
Yeah. What do you want? So evil Billy, well, eviler Billy, tells him he wants him to build what he sees. And then suddenly Billy's back in the right side up and he's waking up from his lifeguard chair and his arm is like third degree burn, like full on sizzling. He stumbles to the bathrooms and then we hear the bells again, the chimes. And then he goes in the cold shower. We see black veins growing inside his arms. He has flashbacks. Heather checks up on him to see if he's all right. And he's kind of like hallucinating that Heather is embodied by this thing telling him to take her to him. And we're like, damn. Wait, what?
Spooky.
And then the scene ends with Heather screaming and it's implied that Billy attacks her. Yikes. And at the mall, Elle is trying on a bunch of outfits. This is the montage that we were talking about. They're doing the photo shoot. Meanwhile, the boys can't find anything.
Such whiplash. Such whiplash.
So at Scoops Ahoy, Robin and Dustin have made progress. They've written out the entire Russian alphabet on their whiteboard. And Steve is serving Max and Elle some ice cream. That's when he's like, wait, are you even supposed to be here? And they just giggle and run away. Outside, they run into the boys with Mike being like, what are you doing here? And then he ignores Max's question about Elle's new style, berates Max for bringing Elle out while
shut
Elle
up,
is
Mike.
Standing right there.
Literally, Mike, shut the fuck up. Like,
he still has a problem with her. It's actually insane. Like, what did she do besides take your girlfriend outside to breathe some fresh air? I don't understand it. I don't understand it. It makes me mad. Like, Max can never have anybody not come at her. So for you to be lying to her, you lie at her for the simplest thing, and then you're caught and you're still trying to lie.
And he's still lying.
He's like, I'm going to go
buy. You lie. Lying. He's like, grandma, Nana, we're here for a gift for her.
Yeah, and I only got $3, so you're going to spend $3 in two gifts. So what was you going to give Grammy? Granny, a penny? A lollipop?
Like, what were you going to give her?
A button?
And poor Lucas is trying to be a good friend and back him up, even though he knows this is just going to dig them both into the hole.
Lucas is such a good friend.
Max is like, you talking?
Max
is like, we're about to have breakup number 6 right here, Lucas.
Hey,
she's like, shape up, boy. He's very well trained.
Will in the back is like, can we please play D&D, sir?
Can we play D&D now?
A nibble, a slice. Lisa, I'm hungry.
Will needs to go hang out with Mr. Clark and play D&D with him.
He needs to open up his group. He needs to go where Dustin is, because maybe then he'll be heard. Because
no, he won't. They'll eat him alive there. No,
it's over for Will. He's in the past. He's like 1 year behind.
Held back a grade. No child left behind, and it's Will.
Oh my God. Where the fuck is Jonathan? Why can't you go with Jonathan?
Yeah, Jonathan, let's go pick up Will. Come on, he needs some help here.
Take him on a tour to see dead rat meat.
So Elle doesn't buy anything that Mike is cooking up, And her bus rolls up and you can see her calculate. And then she looks at Mike and says, I dump your ass. Ooh. And then takes off. Max's jaw's on the ground and she's like so impressed.
I love
it. Then the boys just are like shocked and devastated and watches Max and Elle high five on the bus and take off. And Will's like, thank God.
Women power. Now, womanhood.
Can we play D&D? Like, you could tell he's like, thank God that phase is over. Let's go back to the
he's
old
like,
one.
He's like, you girls.
He said, get him out of here. Boy time. The boys Scram. Are back. Get out. Close the door. Let's ride our bikes home.
So funny.
Please.
The Duffers said that boys at that age, their maturity level, especially their emotional intelligence, is so much lower than that of girls. Yeah. I was like, at every age.
Yeah.
At that age?
Always.
Thank you.
Says the guys that were yelling at women, apparently.
Straight up. Isn't there science that says that men don't like actually mature until age 45 or something?
45?
I don't
Good
remember.
Good G, jolly
that would be,
geez.
That would
Jesus
be hilarious.
Science.
It has been proven scientifically fact.
Don't find a husband until he's 40. Because then his brain will be fully developed.
And by then his pit will be fully bald too. So he develops and bald. So you get the best of both worlds.
You can
Rub
bully him and marry him at the same
Rub
time.
Rub that glow.
I love it.
Oh my gosh. That's so funny. All right, so at town hall, Hop is arresting protesters who are like, the mayor raised my property tax and forced me off my land. Hop's like, you can protest all you want. You just have to go through the proper channels. Flo shows up with a new shirt that Hop ordered. And this is nothing like we have ever seen Hopper wear before. It is literally a Hawaiian shirt. It's like the classic 80s.
It's like angels.
It's like Angel when he was pretending to be Earl or what's his name?
Herb Saunders.
Literally. And Jim's like all giddy and Powell's like, that's a lot of color for you, Chief. And Jim's like, it's cutting edge. I was like, who are you?
Like he's locking in. He's locking in for his boogie.
Yeah. He's going
he bringing
on a
game.
Date.
He bringing the A game to
he
this
said
non-date.
It's not a date.
He's
but...
like, I've been listening to teenagers make out all summer. It is my time to get some.
My time to shine. And I support it.
Oh, my God.
Same.
So apparently his shirt was inspired by the fashion of Magnum P.I., which was what he was watching in the first episode, which is hilarious. And the shirt was custom made due to them needing to make multiples for stunts. The fabric itself was genuine vintage that Paris mass purchased so they didn't run out, which I thought was a lot of the stuff they
what
made
What does that
themselves.
Mean, genuine vintage, though?
It like, means it
of
was
what?
It was. It means, I believe, that it was material actually made in the 80s. Not something that was a replica of something made in the 80s. I believe it was something that was made.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So he arrives at Enzo's, which super nice. There's a string quartet playing. He's dressed up in a suit. He's ordering expensive wine. And I was like, oh, poor Joyce. The moment he said Enzo's, she knew this was a date. Like, there's no way this is not a date. We're not going to sit there and talk about parenting styles while a string quartet is playing and we're sipping on wine. And he's also wearing that loud shirt. Like,
yeah. The whole scenery is romantic, too. It's like you're, it's like an intimate two, like facing each other. It's not like a little bar thing. Like, you're looking at each other. You're going to obviously talk about, you're not going to talk about supernatural stuff with all these people around you. So you're going to be like, how's your day? How was work? So Hopper, you weren't fooling a fly, you weren't fooling her, sadly.
Yeah, and you have to like lean in really close to each other because the string quartet you won't be able to hear, so it like automatically makes it so much sexier. Like, he's smooth, he knows what he's doing.
He knows, he's a smooth one.
That his shirt is so loud it'll make Joyce close her eyes because it's so bright, and then he can lean in and kiss her. That's the overall plan right there.
His shirt is so loud it can light up the dim room in the restaurant. Surely.
He's like completely bombarding her, all her senses. Just overwhelming her completely. All right, so then we have Joyce, who apparently has completely forgotten about everything, is still talking to Mr. Clark. This is when he talks about the magnetic field, how it's destabilizing the magnetization around it, that there would have to be a big machine that would take billions of volts of electricity and cost tens of millions of dollars. We're like, I wonder what that is. Cut to the deserted mall, Except we have Dustin, Robin, and Steve still in the back. They've just finished deciphering the first part of the code. The week is long. The silver cat feeds when blue meets yellow in the west. They close up. They talk about the code. Steve's thinking it's nonsense. And Robin and Dustin are like, we're on the same brain wavelength here. They're like, it's definitely a code. And then Steve stops by a quarter horse and then turns it on. And then that's when they all realize that that's the
music
that was playing.
Don't ever underestimate Steve again.
He's so much smarter than everybody gives him credit for.
They just brush him off. And it's like, just listen to him one time.
Like, at least once. Like, he has a brain.
Yeah.
A little bit. Come on, y'all.
Like, he's made it this far in this game of Upside Down.
Yeah. Lest we all forget, this man went after a Demogorgon.
Like, literally. With his prickly bat.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just all brawn. Like, he had to use some brains there, too, with, like, strategically getting it into the hallway. And then, like, he's smart.
Stop underestimating him, guys.
Yep.
Come on.
So at Enzo's, Joy still has not arrived. Hop is getting increasingly drunker and angrier. He watches all the happy couples around him. He's like, my own daughter can get some and I can't. He then drunkenly slaps a tip down, grabs the full bottle of wine, says he can do whatever he wants. He's the chief of police, and then leaves. But then we see that he knocked into Terminator guy and we're like, ooh, is he watching him? And then at the Steelworks building, Billy pulls a tied up and unconscious Heather from his trunk and
so
brings
creepy.
Her to the basement. Places her on the ground. She comes to, struggles. Billy like leans in and is like, don't be afraid.
This is literally every woman's like worst nightmare. Honestly.
Literally. Yeah.
To be honest, like, this also seems on brand for Billy.
Yeah, he would.
Yeah,
possessed
does.
Or not, this still feels like Billy.
Mm-hmm. That's why that's why our opinions on Billy is so iffy. I fear, because I feel like this is like something he would do, but I think one thing that I'm intrigued to see is that while yes, he's possessed by this entity, I hope you guys are forgetting that he's also a demon IRL. Let's hope that this doesn't clog your sympathy card, guys, because y'all love
okay
to
do
that.
I do have
our
something
yearly
to say,
reminder.
I will say, though, I feel like the way Dacre Montgomery played this scene was very interesting. It's almost like at certain points you could almost see Billy being like horrified that he's doing this.
Yeah, like trying to break through.
Like trying to stop himself from doing it almost, or like kind of not like being able to see what he's doing, but not being able to stop himself from doing it. And I thought that was really interesting.
I agree.
Because it's like, Billy's in there still. Like, you can tell the way he plays it. It's like Billy is, he knows what he's doing, but it's almost like he can't stop. So I really liked those, like, acting choices.
Yeah,
it's actually intriguing because, like, we saw, like, obviously when the entity possessed Will, like, it was predominantly controlling Will more than anything else. So even to the point where, like, he obviously will choke his mom because of this entity. But with Billy, he's older. So obviously there's more restraint in his mind. He can actually fight more than, you know, since Will was a kid. So you're watching this, like, a different life stage, like, try to combat this, like, powerful entity, to where like you see him trying to fight back like these temptations that this, you know, entity is trying to portray him, like when they try to have
him with,
like,
Karen
and then the girl in the shower. He tried to for so long, he tried to like fight it off by like constantly even trying to like deviate from things. So like you can see that Billy is not a full-on like, oh, I'm gonna just do what he says. He's still trying to, you know, like obviously fight back, but I feel like he's still confused, because even if he wants to go back to normal, he doesn't even know what they want. That's why that line of he doesn't understand is just insanity, because what does an entity want? Because you're seeing you're seeing entity like possess Billy, but you're also seeing like something related to Upside Down having rats just blow up. They're eating dirt. So it's like, it's intriguing, because you're just like, how does these all intermingle with each other? And why is Billy the bigger, well, we know why Billy, but like, what is the bigger picture that Billy needs to bring this random swimsuit, you know, person that he works with to this like underground building where even his, like, you know, demise started, was in his place. So it's intriguing but also scary.
Yeah, I just absolutely love that, like you guys were saying, you can see the nuance on his face. You see him fighting it several times this episode. And then ultimately, obviously, capitulating, and because it probably takes over. Like, he starts to seem to not be able to differentiate between reality and what is delusion.
Yeah.
And they do a good job of showing us from Billy's perspective of how he's perceiving things and what he's fighting against. And it does help us empathize with him a little bit, because obviously nobody deserves this. But yeah, it's very interesting. It's quite a different path that they take him down than I expected. Like, I remember first time watching this being like, I didn't think Billy was going to end up being the victim of the season, you know?
I think that's the most intriguing thing, is especially with like how at the end of season two, he was like obviously like the little mini antagonist, to like now him being taken over because of the like wrong place, or maybe he was the right place. He might be was the right target, I guess, for this entity. We'll have to figure it out. But to see that, even like, you know, he fought, and I mean, maybe what was it, maybe a day or two, so he's been trying to fight for like a solid day, and I feel like you see how much it exhausts him, to where like he's sweating profusely, like it's like an inner battle in his body. He has bruises, he's like fading in and out, to where like even if he fades out for 1 minute, that means that the entity can full on control him. So
yeah,
it's like, it's kind of scary, because if the entity can like control that rat that died, and then Billy, this he has, and then maybe even taking over the girl that was just taken, who else can he take over? Because now it's Nana was just given that he could take over like the Demogorgons and just Will, but now it's given that his powers, obviously his power scale increased to where he can do several people at once. So that's very scary. Mm-hmm. Get him out of here.
Yeah, well, thank you, Naj, for joining us and talking about this with us.
Happy to be here.
This was fun. Yeah,
it was fun.
It's a good episode.
Yeah,
it makes a lot happened. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it takes like sometimes with these shows though, it's like when you're watching it as a regular viewer, it's like amazing, but when you're analyzing it for a podcast, it makes you start to like be like,
You so, break like, it down a little bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like the episode was not bad. It made me actually grow a little appreciation than what I said in the beginning, because like the clock, and then Billy, and then the fact that Billy went through a lot, and then even like y'all podcast episode helped me with Billy, because I didn't know there was a book that talked about him a little bit, so that is why it made me connect just now, or like earlier when I was like, oh my god, he has a troubled life, and that's why. And then
season four adds a lot more context, I think, to why some of these people have what they have going on. All right, well, Naj, where can our listeners find you, and what are you covering right now? Are you finishing up Charmed?
Yes, at this point, y'all, bear with my life. I'm on there.
She's like, right,
I'm
now
still doing Charmed.
I'm still here. If y'all know that meme, please. I'm still here. I'm almost done Charmed. Teen Wolf is literally done. Two episodes, three episodes left. Revenge is almost done. So I'm wrapping up three shows. So I'm trying to figure out what shows to watch. Yes. All of them have been rage baiting me. So I'm just here.
She needs a good palate cleanser, guys.
Palette cleanse, and this was the best thing.
Suggest some shows for Naj to watch and react to.
Please, please, my spirits.
You should watch Supernatural.
Oh my gosh.
Hell!
100 seasons later.
100 seasons later, 20. No, actually, that creator, he lost me, because he also writes The Boys. The way that you wrote The Boys for season 5, you actually will never come to my TV screen ever again.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, listen, Supernatural is like a very good show, but it's like a show going on for that long.
It's a big
show. It just can't
show.
Be sustained. Like, the quality can't be sustained that long. 1 million.
Naj, are you watching shows that are currently still running, or you only watch shows that are finished? I have a couple suggestions.
I don't mind. I just think, I would like to hear that. I don't have any, like,
because Andrew and I, we got sick for like a month, and so we binged a lot of shows. I highly recommend Widow's Bay. I don't know if you've seen
Widow's
Bay. I really
want to watch that.
Yes, it is a horror comedy.
Yeah.
And
me and my coworker are actually planning on doing like a night a week where we watch.
Do it,
Leia. Go to somebody's house and watch Widow's Bay.
Do it, and then you'll tell me all about it. Widow's Bay. And then From.
Yeah, that one.
Yes.
Yeah, my cousin watched that one. Let me
Severance is a really good one. Severance.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen Breaking Bad?
I haven't.
No, I haven't.
Would that be a good one for her to cover?
Yeah, is it Raised
I haven't seen it, but I know that it's very popular and it's very good. Yeah.
And then Andrew and I just watched, it's a new show that just came out this year. There's a lot of really good ones, but it's been renewed for a second season and stuff. It's called Pluribus. And the premise is, I think I told Leia about it. It's about this girl who there's some sort of like alien virus that comes and it ends up like taking over the human population and killing like a third of the world. But the people who survive are all taken over by this alien, except for her and like a handful of people from all around the world. And the alien that takes over is trying it's trying to help it. And it believes that it can't actually kill anything and that it's only making people their lives better by assimilating them into this hive mind. And so she's like one of the only people that as actively trying to fight against the aliens and their assimilation. And it's, I cannot recommend it enough. It is so interesting in how they show like what would happen if that actually like went around, like some of the people like the aliens because the aliens will do whatever they say. So there's like one guy who like flies around in Air Force One and has like a whole harem of women to choose from. And then, you know, it's like realistic to what would happen. Yeah. And then I won't give away anymore, but it honestly is really interesting and actually kind of funny too. At the same time, so
I'm gonna add that because the only recent show that I've watched that's like ongoing, I actually watched the Stranger Things Duffer Brothers adult version of Stranger Things that got canceled.
Oh, yeah, I know.
My dad was watching that, so I watched it with him, and it was something. It was
something else.
I heard it was Yellow Jackets. Super good.
It wasn't. Oh, yeah. It wasn't good. I don't want to spoil it for anybody that want to watch it. So
yeah,
I'm just not going to say
it. Watch it.
Yeah, it's like these old folks' home where they like stay, and you know, obviously the main character of the dad, he stays there, and apparently there's like a tube in each of the old folks' home where this like alien creature comes in and drinks some of their brain matter to feed their mom, which is an alien that ends up becoming almost human-like because it eats on humans' brain. And so the founders of the old folks' home is this couple that have been alive and hasn't aged for decades because they feed on the mother's like blood or whatever. So they basically have her hooked up in like this room, and they drink her serum or whatever so they can stay young forever. And it's like a couple of them that just there. So the main premise is they're trying to hire a scientist that can keep the mother alive so she can keep them as young as at forever. That's literally the principle of it. So like,
oh, okay,
it's like a, and then like I think one of the people find like a fruit that also contains it. It's like she's like an alien, but it was and it was crazy.
Bizarre.
The actress, it was. I was watching it, but I was like, what the fuck is going on? And they even had the actress from Hunger Games, the actress who plays Johanna, she was on there. And I was like, girl, what are you doing over here?
Well, you'll have to let us know what you choose, because I'm very excited.
Yes.
I love your reactions, and I think you're ready to try something different, try something new.
Something new. Something maybe for the raise. Something
maybe
fun.
Something a little shorter.
Yes. Yeah. Something not 20 episodes of pain.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. It's a good life on that side of that.
Sadly. Yeah.
There's some really good stuff coming out right now too. Mm-hmm. So you're gonna have a lot of fun kind of finding stuff and jumping around. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Let us know your thoughts on the episode. Did you guys feel like there was just too much going on? Did you like the pacing? What did you guys think about Max and Elle's relationship? Elle and Mike, Max and Lucas, Joyce and Hopper, all of the stuff happening with Billy. This was a really interesting Billy episode. If you guys have seen the rest of the show, you'll have to let us know what you were thinking when Billy was possessed and all the Easter eggs and everything that's happening in season 4. Thanks for listening, you guys, and we will talk to you next time. Thanks so much for listening to Investigating. If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to follow, subscribe, and review us on all platforms. You can also find us on Instagram at investigatingpodcast, and you can continue to email us at investigatingangelpodcast@gmail.com.